let me go back to this discussion of Marshall and bring Rockow into this.
All right. Rockow, again, had his own laboratory under Marshall, and the minute Rockow got this result, fairly good yields in the direct process, Marshall threw more effort onto it and had a couple of people start to try to scale it up. And the first thing you do, Rockow's first reactor, I think, I don't know, was 3/4 inch in diameter or something like that. And Marshall then started to try to build larger diameter units, static bed units. This was 1940 because he realized they had to have more material in order to develop enough varnish, and it was still polymers used in varnish at that point, to coat cloth or to coat glass cloth. That was primarily what they were doing then. They'd get the methyl chlorosilanes and separate them and make the resins and coat cloth, and then use the cloth as an insulating material in a small machine. Marshall realized he had to have more, so he just did his best at that time by trying to scale up the static beds. And they, when I arrived in 42, they had developed, I would say, as an inventory, which they were very careful to dole out small quantities to people who would use it sparingly, maybe a few gallons of the different materials that they had very laboriously prepared in small static bed reactors and small diameter distillation columns. Rockow, in the meantime, had gone on to trying to develop the phenyl chlorosilane, where you were reacting chlorobenzene with, he finally hit upon silver silicon as a catalyst. It's a much, much more difficult process and has been a very intractable process. I haven't followed it in the last 5 or 6 years, but it's still a very, I'm sure, a very difficult process compared to the methyl chlorosilanes. Mm-hmm. And has never, I don't think they have ever gotten it up to the fluid bed stage, but I don't know where I shouldn't say I haven't followed it for 5-6 years.
Did they get on well together?
Rockow and Marshall?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know Rockow's fundamental thoughts on it, but I mean, I think he worked well with Marshall. I mean, he was a very independently minded fellow, and so was Marshall.
That's why I asked the question.
But I don't, certainly I don't think it interfered any with Rockow's creativity.
Mm-hmm.
Because Rockow, if he felt like it, could turn right around and go down to see Coolidge. I mean, that's the way the laboratory worked in those days. Mm-hmm. Rockow
felt a greater responsibility, I think, to Navius than he did to Marshall, because I think Navius brought him in originally to do inorganic
work. Yep, that's right.
Yeah. And he always felt a certain responsibility to Navius. And Marshall didn't have Navius involved in the silicon work at all. Oh, I tell you, you never find an organization the way that one was. If you want to look at Marshall's overall record, and Lebowski, I can tell you, agreed 100% with it. Marshall had an outstanding overall record as an industrial chemical research director, because when you've got to give Marshall a lot of credit for formbar enamel, you got to give them credit for silicones, you got to give them credit for permafills. OGE never really exploited those the way later one of the GE chemists did, Bob Preble through the Loctite Corporation. You got to give Marshall credit for diamonds. You got to give him credit for polyxylene. And not very much on polycarbonates, but they did come out of the lab and they moved out pretty fast over Pittsfield. But there are very few that have a record like that, and you can't really lay it to broad strategic planning of some kind, but it's just because he had some good people there, and he was all, as I think, for trying anything. He really had an unusual type of mind.
Mm-hmm. Who was your boss?
Marshall was my boss, yeah, when I first came, and then when I moved down to Insulated Materials, my boss was the general manager of that department, a fellow by the name of Ed Feininger. And I haven't yet come then to a major organizational change that took place in the in 1945, when General Electric really set up an organizational structure that made it clear they were going to support going into chemical manufacturing on a more serious basis. They had a study made by Dr. Zay Jeffries, who came out of the lamp division in Cleveland. Jeffries was also from Case. He was a 1914 graduate and taught at Case for a while, and he's a metallurgist. And had done consulting work for the Aluminum Company of America, did all his life, and really worked for the Aluminum Company and also for the lamp division as a consultant. Mm-hmm. Maintained a great many interests, and made one of his big achievements was in bringing the tungsten carbide manufacturing process from Germany over into this country and setting up the Carbaloy company as a subsidiary of General Electric. And later on, he was taken to court for that, and when the antitrust laws were much more stringent than they are today. But Jeffries was commissioned by Charlie Wilson, then President G, to make a general study of General Electric's going into chemistry. This had been much talked about, as I say, in the research laboratory, in the Insulating Materials Department, in the Transformer Department in Pittsfield, and the Lamp Division, which was really in chemistry because it had its own plant for refining tungsten ore to sodium tungstate in Cleveland. That was another part of GE that had always impressed me and was in the back of my mind when I went with them, because Case was quite close in, on a consulting basis to the GE lamp division. And as an undergraduate, one summer we took a number of plant trips around the country, and in Cleveland itself we went through the lamp division. They had a brand new plant for converting tungsten ore into tungsten. It was terribly impressive to everybody. Brand spanking new plant. Well, Jeffries was commissioned to make this study, and he suggested setting up a chemical department that would have as its basis the plastics department of General Electric and the Insulating Materials Department. Combine those two, they were not departments, they were really divisions, I guess, at the time, or operations. But plastics was in Pittsfield and was involved in custom molding and in making phenolic compounds, and has grown up as a result of General Electric's early interest in making phenolic molding compounds. This was another strain in the business that I haven't touched upon until this time. the General Electric people had developed their own molding compounds and made them in a plant in the Pittsfield Transformer Works. And they had five plants scattered in the east, then not only for molding Bakelite compounds, as they were called at that time. GE had its own trade name for their phenolic molding compound, textilite molding compound. Mm-hmm. And they molded other plastics at that time. The thermoplastics they molded were cellulose acetate primarily, and then they got into polystyrene as it came into the picture in the 30s. And into those were really the only significant molding compounds at that time. Jeffrey suggested combining the plastics division. Well, and the plastics division, as I told you originally, was going integrating the phenol because they had this phenolic molding compound plant. Jeffrey's that phenol plant was just being completed in 1945 while this study was in progress. So Jeffrey suggested combining these two, and he was made vice president of the chemical and metallurgy. It was called chemical department at that time. They didn't bring metallurgy in at that point. Jeffrey continued his role as the chairman of the board of the Carbaloy Company, which was run as a subsidiary of General Electric. And only later, in 1951, I guess it was Carbaloy folded in, and they called it the Chemical and Metallurgical Division of the company. Well, Jeffries took on that job in 1945, at the end of the year, 46. And the department headquarters were set up in Pittsfield, and the department was looking, of course, to grow, and they saw as one of the big growth possibilities silicones. Silicones were still under the aegis of the insulating materials department at that time. Well, Jeffries saw that if they were going to grow, they have to have a new technology sponsorship in the chemical department itself. Mm-hmm. So he set up a chemical engineering division and made me the general manager of that division in 1946.
Mm-hmm.
And my first job was to continue designing the first silicone plant and following its construction. But the business responsibility for that development stayed with the Insulated Materials Department. So the Chemical Engineering Division was charged not only with getting that silicone plant going, but also it was charged with developing additional new polymers, which were being investigated by the Laboratory of the Plastics Department in Pittsfield. And that was the department that I mentioned was responsible for the phenol plant development and for a lot of other polymers under this fellow Delalio. And Delalio had gotten upset with General Electric not moving fast enough in chemistry, and he left GE, I guess in 1944 or so, and went with the Procolec Brush Company over in North Adams that was trying to get into chemistry at that time, and continued a lot of very innovative work with them, but they had no business in trying to get into chemistry such a small company.
Yeah.
But this, and then later on, this fellow went on to be a professor of chemistry, I think, at the University of Illinois.
Delalio.
He was in a class by himself as a polymer chemist, believe me.
That's interesting, the point that you just bring up. You needed a lot of capital then to do these sort of things. It wasn't the type of thing that a small company couldn't go into the manufacture of phenol or silicone precursors and so on. So that GE had an advantage in this.
Well, they as I say, there has been all this talk about how GE has made excellent chemical developments, but they would then turn them over to somebody else who would exploit them and profit from them. They felt that they had made a great development in formwar wire enamel, and here was Monsanto and others exploiting, making a lot of money on that because they produced the polymer. Mm. And in polyvinyl chloride, the same thing. It was a very successful installation in its day. GE had done a lot of work on it, and yet Goodrich was the main developer there. So they were poised to exploit the next development internally. And there were all sorts of opinions in the company as to whether this was a wise thing to do or not. The apparatus people in GE were dead set against it because their customers were the big chemical companies. Mm-hmm. And believe me, some of the chemical companies brought all kinds of pressure to bear on GE not to go into the chemical business. Union Carbide being one of the worst. They threatened to take business away if GE went into integrated into chemistry. But opinion, fortunately, prevailed that GE should grow by exploiting its developments from within, and silicones was such an unusual opportunity that that was the first vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Was there one big champion, or was it Jeffries, or was it a lot?
Well, Jeffries was a big champion, and of course the research laboratory was a big champion, and the insulating materials people were champions, but ambivalent in a way, because it fell on their shoulders to take the responsibility and spend the money. So that they had to be pushed some. Ralph Kortner was a great proponent of growth in the chemical field.
His portrait is right outside. He was the president of Columbia University.
No. This is somebody else. This is Ralph Kortner, who was president of General Electric.
Yeah, but now which Kortner was the president?
This was an entirely different one. The one that was in the United Nations. Wasn't that the one that Cordier, I think, is his name. Cordner, C-O-R-D-I-N-E-R. Yeah. Totally entirely different fellow. He was chairman of the board at General Electric.
Really, you were the in charge of the chemical engineering
department. Chemical engineering.
What were the big challenges in building the waterproof plant, which I guess if you say was your main job?
That was my main job as head of the general manager of this new division of the, at that time it was called the division of the chemical engineering department. And I was responsible for getting the plant built and also for some of the work that was going on in Pittsfield.
So there's the chemicals department at this point.
Yeah.
And there are silicones, and there's this new venture into phenolics, which
that's
is
right.
Just beginning in earnest.
Phenol.
Making phenol.
That's where we were in 1946.
So they went into that business in support of their molding compounds
operation.
To provide them with raw
materials. Right, because they foresaw that when this decision was made back in the decision to get into phenol was made really back in 1938 or 9. And the development work went on, and the plant was started in 42.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there was great disagreement within the company as to whether they should do it or not. And this insulating materials department was very much against their ever getting into phenol. And it turns out they were right, I mean, because it was one of the most boring ventures that the company ever got into. When you think of trying to get into phenol, the first nameplate design done by the Lummus Company to GE's specifications was 7.5 million pounds a year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at that time, phenol was maybe
100 or 150 million pounds a year production in this country, so that would be a larger proportion, of course, than it would be today, but it was still a small plant, and it was doubled to 15 million in the course of early design, and went on stream with a nameplate capacity of 15 million pounds, which was very small, but it wasn't the economics of the thing that killed it. The fact that the process just would never work on a larger scale. It just could never overcome some of the corrosion product in the reactor itself, and to make another long story short, the plant was finally shut down in 1949 and never really operated. It made, you know, a few million pounds of phenol, but just could never keep running because of the reactor problem.
Of course, by 1949,
at the 48. Hercules started doing process on the cumene, doing work on the cumene process. I went down at a very early stage and went through the Hercules cumene process, and it was quite clear that that's what was really going to come along in the future. It took a great many years before the first big cumene plant was built.
Mm-hmm.
And a few more years before Dow shut down all of their high-pressure chlorobenzene operations, and Monsanto and one other, Ryko, shut down the old sulfonating process.
Wait, we're not trying to jump the story here, but just since we're talking about phenol, would polycarbonate not have been possible with out a good phenol process like the Hercules process to give you a, you know?
Well, I don't see any connection. Polycarbonate depends upon having good bisphenol A, to the extent that you couldn't refine phenol to the point where you could make good bisphenol A.
Okay.
There might have been a problem, but there was really never any problem like that with polycarbonate.
Okay. Well, anyway, we have a chemicals department, silicones. You've built a plant. It almost seems like a meteoric rise. You're out of school 4 years, essentially, and you're the general manager of this new engineering department.
Yeah.
Did you feel that you were? Did you have a sense of your presence in the company at that?
No, I really didn't. Again, I was just, so interested in.
Do you still consider yourself a technical person, an engineer?
I really still considered myself a technical person, although I was very aware of the economics of plant design, and I remember during the course of that plant design, we started off at one capacity, and I remember one weekend making a rough calculation on the overall plant, rough estimate of billing out of the plant and so on, and I said it would never go unless we doubled. So we doubled the size of the plant on that weekend.
And that turned out to be the right...
Well, it turned out to be, if we hadn't, we'd have been in real trouble because the operations that we were, some of the operations in the plant are very scale sensitive. Distillation is very scale sensitive. I mean, if I build a plant that's going to have a capacity of 5 million pounds a year, and I build distillation columns that will balance at 5 million pounds per year, I can double the size by spending only 40% more. It goes up with the square inch, roughly.
So the bigger one, you can afford to make use of the process.
And it takes more money at the time, but if you have any confidence at all in what's going to happen to the business, and you gamble on a larger unit because you have all the
economy of scale.
Realize the economy of scale. Some of the processes
in the early plant were scale sensitive and others weren't. But the total infrastructure that you put in is very sensitive to scale. I mean, your water supply, your your waste disposal, inventory, tankage, and so on, particularly distillation.
Did you have a hard time when you made these decisions selling them up to the company, or were you left more or less on your own?
No, I was more or less on my own and working with the insulating materials people and Jeffries then.
And Rockow is gone at this point.
Rockow left in 46, I think.
Yeah.
Rockow never had any relation at all to the engineering scale of things.
Because it didn't interest him, or
he was in another field. I think Rockow started in doing some work on the boron chemistry at that time. Boron just took over for a while in the lab.
They
said, "Here we're going to do the same. Maybe we can do the same thing with boron that we did with silicon." And I can understand that thrill on the part of the chemists. I mean, they felt they had done they'd skimmed off the cream on silicone by that time.
Mm-hmm.
And from a chemical point of view, the cream was skimmed. It was coming so fast from 39 to 42 or 43.
Mm-hmm.
And from that time on, it was a sort of a chemical development job, and the chemical thrill was over.
Mm-hmm. You got the plant going, I guess, what, about 49 or 50?
The plant got going in 48, I would say.
How was the business doing at that time?
Well, that's a totally different story. In the meantime, from 46 on, and starting before 46, when the insulating materials people were given responsibility for moving this thing along, it was realized that you just had to have some product development work if you were to be able to build the first plant to a size that would be economically attractive at all. When you've always got a chicken-egg proposition when you're developing a brand new thing like silicones. You've got a lot of exciting applications, but they may add up to 100,000 pounds a year. A lot of excitement, a lot of enthusiasm, but 100,000 pounds a year is nothing as far as an economic-sized plant is concerned. So you've got to have the applications to support the plant, and you've got to have the plant to support the applications. And you've got to gamble on that first plant, always. If you build it too small, you're not going to ever be able to make a profit out of it. If you build it too large, and it takes too long to develop applications to move up to capacity, you're going to lose a lot of money. So there's a very, very much of a gamble and a lot of judgment involved on how large a scale you're going to make that plant. You also know that the process technology is going to continue to change, and you don't want to overbuild from that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So it's consider myself very fortunate to have had that experience on those fundamentals of plant design. It's something that, even today you can have all sorts of elaborate mathematics and linear programming and everything else, but to decide on what the first capacity of any plant is going to be, if it's a brand new product, takes a lot of judgment and a lot of...
This is going to be a good time to use appointment given those stops.
Let's stop.
Yeah.